Hi, you're listening to the Majority Report with Sam Cedar, Special Hurricane Edition. Now, as you can see, it's raining now, and we're waiting for the hurricane to come. It's about 2 hours. So, everybody, get your flashlights, get stuff ready, and be safe. Now what?
Hello, folks. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator right now and save $50 on your device purchase at MajorityReport.ting.com.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 30th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape, not in the metaphorical or literal shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I'm actually recording this as I speak from my dining room, living room, desk area in my apartment. There is no transportation, public transportation in New York City. I don't know if there's cabs out there at all. But yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're providing you a program today. Matt, Michael, stuck in the outer boroughs, water having poured into the subway system in New York City. Power still remains out in about a third of Manhattan. Fortunately, we live way uptown. We have power. But Hurricane Sandy did its work on the city. And to the extent that there's any type of silver lining here, maybe it will wake people up to climate change. I doubt it, but hope springs eternal. Now, to get a quick report on exactly what took place over the past 24 hours. Oh, I should say, on the program today, we will have Fred Kaplan. I interviewed him yesterday via phone. Quality should be okay. He is the author of Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. But before we get there, I think we probably should get a wrap-up on the hurricane from our special hurricane reporter. Of course, I'm talking about Myla Cedar. Hold on. Here she comes.
As you know, my dad told you that the power went out downtown, way downtown, and now, like he said, we live way uptown. And it's passing through New York City. Last night it felt very windy and we could hear the wind. It was blowing like... It was very, very windy and I couldn't fall asleep. And I was a little bit scared because... So my mom had to lay down with me for a little bit.
Hold on for 1 second. Let's make that really official. All right, and go. Any more report you want to give? Tell people
and
be safe.
Be safe inside. And as like you know, the trees fell down. And some trees fell down way downtown. I'm not talking about here because here we have... But some branches fell down, so thank you so much, Majority, for having me.
All right, well, thank you, Myla Cedar, for that comprehensive report on the hurricane. All right, folks, now sit back, and we will now have Fred Kaufman, author of Bet the Farm. We will be back live tomorrow. I'm not sure how, but we'll figure it out. So until tomorrow, see you then. Thanks. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase at MajorityReport.ting.com. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Ting. Ting. T-I-N-G is a new mobile service that makes sense. It's all about billing clarity, usability, and big savings to mobile phone users. It has a simple plan with honest, fair pricing that bills megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately. With Ting, if you use less than anticipated, you're automatically credited the difference at the end of the month. Ting means big savings. You can head over to Ting. To MajorityReport.ting.com right now. Use their usage calculator. See how much cash you're going to save using Ting, and you get $50 off your device purchases there. Check it out. They have great customer support. It's run by a bunch of geeks. Ting.com. It just makes sense.
We'll show the world that the boys are back to stay. And you all know what we can do. Jump high, fight another way for the red, white, and blue. New York belongs to me. A city's bright, dirty water in a Hudson River. No one can take away the memory. Oh, New York belongs to me.
We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report, on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Frederick Kaufman. He is a writer for Harper's Magazine, a professor at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism, and I should say contributing editor at Harper's, and author of the new Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. Welcome to the program, Frederick.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing well. We are both safely ensconced in our apartments right now without any public transportation in New York City. But what better time to talk about food?
That's right. Everybody's buying a lot of it.
So let's start. I mean, you start your book on with pizza. Why, aside from the fact that it is pizza is great, why pizza?
Well, Sam, it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I had what I thought was a really simple question to start off my book, which is that why can't delicious, healthy, and inexpensive food be available for everybody on Earth. I mean, after all, every year we actually create more than twice the amount of food needed to feed everybody, and yet we still have almost a billion hungry people. So I said, why can't this happen? And I thought I would start with what seemed to me to be the simplest answer of all, which is takeout pizza. Why can't everybody on Earth simply eat takeout pizza? I thought this could be a solution, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, of course, but it, of course, brought me to the corporate headquarters of Domino's and Tyson Foods, and it really opened up this whole notion of why does hunger have to happen? Why is the price of global food spinning out of control and going through the roof? And it was kind of a good way to start the story.
And so where did that lead? I mean, one of the things that really I think will surprise people is to know that in the past, I guess, 3 years, we've had two of the biggest bumper crops of wheat in years. And
in history, let's say in history.
In history. So, I mean, this is pretty stunning because my understanding of why food prices have gone up, I mean, partly in this country, we're very sensitive to the price of corn, obviously, and there's been droughts in this country, but globally speaking, I know that we are dealing with climate change, which of course is, we had huge fires in Russia a couple years ago. I mean, we've lost a lot of crops to global climate change, but yet we're having these bumper crops, and we're not seeing it reflected in the price of food.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, which is that you're right. In this year in the United States and in Russia, we actually saw drought, but in other parts of the world, we have a bumper crop of wheat, such as in Latin America. And this happened in 2008, where we had the greatest wheat harvest in history, and yet the price of food went through the roof. I think that there are a lot of factors here, obviously, and if you talk to the traders on Wall Street, if you talk to the traders in Chicago or Minneapolis or Kansas City, they'll say biofuel mandates, drought, flood, climate change. They'll give you a whole host of reasons. And in fact, one of the reasons we're seeing right now, very interesting, is that Iran is actually trading a lot of their oil for wheat since they have an embargo on everything else. So Iran is actually hoarding wheat. Cargill, as we all know, hoards wheat. ADM hoards wheat. But all the economists try to crunch these numbers and to try to understand, okay, that is a lot of demand pressure, but we do have plenty of supply still, and to what extent can that account for the price rise? And there's this huge, nebulous, cloudy, strange area of price rise. Nobody can account for this, and this is Wall Street speculation. And what is interesting is that since the global economic meltdown in 2008, this Wall Street speculation in food has gained a lot of traction.
And it's gained a lot of traction as a story or as a phenomena?
As a phenomena. The what happened in 2008 really has been a game changer in terms of global food going forward. And in a nutshell, a lot of the money managers and the hedge fund managers and the sovereign wealth fund managers on Wall Street, not to mention the investment bankers, found themselves in 2008 with a problem, which is that they're sitting on huge wads of cash, don't know what to do with it. We see it as still a problem. In other words, really wasn't a good idea to put it in stocks that were tanking or in real estate that was tanking or in debt markets that had completely collapsed or in, you know, mortgage-backed securities, anything like this, and these derivatives are going down and down. So where do you find a safe place to put your money? You can't even put your money in money because the currencies themselves are in a race to the bottom. Euros are down, dollars are down. So everybody's doing some chin scratching out there, and then they realize kind of what a lot of us have known for a while, which is that there is real abiding and strong value in arable land, fresh water, and food. And so what we had is a relatively small expert-based market in commodities and in food commodities being completely transformed by hundreds of billions of dollars of new money pouring in almost all on the demand side. Give me this stuff to hold for as long as possible for the price side rise.
Okay, so I want to go back to the pizza as we sort of have these two tracks that are taking place that are impacting our food. So you went, you had this idea that we could feed the world with pizza, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it is actually an interesting question. I mean, pizza seems relatively inexpensive and somewhat, at least, you know, I don't know if it's nutritious, but it certainly has, you know, a little bit of protein, a little bit of carbs. And so what happened once you got to that corporate level?
So really what makes pizza such a great place to start, at least what I realized when I got there, was that if you think about the pie, it is actually made up of all of these commodified elements, these globally traded transnational commodified elements. So in other words, the crust is made of commodity wheat and commodity soy crush, more commonly known as vegetable oil. And then over that, we have tomatoes, and tomatoes are, in the vegetable kingdom, the largest global commodity-like element. On top of that, we have commodity cheese made of commodity milk, both of which are traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And then, of course, it's topped by commodity beef and commodity pork in the form of pepperoni, let's say. And so this one little takeout pizza is the nexus of all of these different transnational commodities. And what I saw were two separate phenomena here.
Fred, hold on. Let me ask you this one question. What do you mean by, when you say commodity cheese or commodity beef, explain to our audience what you mean by that.
Okay, so first, two things, really. One is that they actually, livestock and cheese and milk are all traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, okay? So that's on the very basic, defining something by its definition, that's what I mean. But what is a commodity? I think we should just think about that also. Commodities generally have to reach two criteria in order to be considered commodities. One is that it's pretty much the same anywhere. So my Argentinian steak and my steak from the American Midwest, or my steak from the Ukraine, or grain from any of those three places, if they're the same grade and quality, they're pretty much interchangeable with each other. And so that's the first criteria of commodity. And the second is it's readily exchangeable for cash wherever you are. And so that's kind of that's the definition of commodity. And so because these things are readily exchangeable for cash, for instance, in the Midwest, if you're holding a lot of wheat, you say you're holding cash. They'll say, oh, I'm holding cash. That means they have wheat. So that's what commodity means. This is an equivalency between money and this element. And, of course, what's interesting here is, like money, there are real similarities. In other words, they're both – the great word I love is fungible. They're fungible elements. In other words, by using it, you consume it. That's with food. By using food, you consume it. And the same thing with money. However, there are some key differences that Wall Street has neglected to notice, which is that food is not money. And that's part of the point of the book is kind of understanding that these two things have converged. And by converging, there are really devastating consequences for the rest of the world.
Okay.
And the global food system.
You were saying that as you got up this, as you realized this pizza is made up of just a series of commodified products,
right.
you noticed two separate phenomena.
Right, two separate phenomena. And one has been widely noted, which is that the industrialization of the food system is kind of this Walmartification pressure being put on suppliers, really pushes the price down and makes life really tough for farmers, particularly small farmers. Okay, and so what we see is collusion. It almost is comic, but we've seen collusion and lawsuits and monopolization and manipulation of, let's say, the price of cheese and the price of milk, right? And we've just seen articles recently about Dean Foods and about how this has been a real bad there's been a lot of bad acting in terms of trying to set that price as low as possible, okay, and really hurt farmers who cannot make a living. On the other hand, there's another phenomena. There's the industrialization, and then there's also the securitization, or what I call the financialization of the entire sector. And so that has actually in some ways had the opposite effect, and this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the price of wheat becoming financialized and thus being traded like stocks or bonds or whatever, momentum trading, second-by-second computer trading program, and this is increasing the volatility and sending the price ever higher. This, too, you would think that might even it out for the farmer. He can sell or she can sell the wheat for ever more money. In fact, both of them hurt the producers because as the price of wheat spirals out of control, so does the price of all the inputs to make wheat, the fertilizer, the diesel, the everything that is needed, the seeds, everything that is needed, the price is also rising. And so both of these work as a double whammy on the farmer and as a triple whammy on the consumer. So who wins? The farmer doesn't win. Not even McDonald's and the guys in Nestle, not even the guys in the middle win. And certainly the consumers are the big losers to devastating consequence. People who win are the bankers.
Wow. And so how so you've got this, I mean, you were mentioning this notion of economists are crunching these numbers. They're crunching the inputs. They're crunching the outputs. They're finding this sort of like dark matter, if you will, where
yeah, that's right.
Where it goes into the sort of the black box, the function machine, and it comes out in a way that is inexplicable based upon these inputs, based upon the different things that would influence the price of food. And so yeah. This is basically, it's speculation, yes?
Yes, but you see, I really like that metaphor of this kind of black box or this dark matter, because if you talk to people in the business, they'll tell you hogwash. For every buyer, there's a seller. Markets work perfectly. This is how price discovery works. That's the language they use. This is price discovery. And you realize that what we're saying here is not at all uncontroversial. This is an extremely controversial assessment to say that the reason the price of global grain tripled from 2002 to 2012 is very much part and parcel of Wall Street speculation, because it is extremely hard to look back at transactions in commodity markets and to say, oh, that was a transaction made by a farmer and that was a transaction made by a banker who's speculating, because that's not the way the markets are set up, and there's very little transparency in these markets and there's very little regulation in these markets, and a lot of the bankers are now exempt from any kind of limit on the positions they take. And plus, there are all these what are called over-the-counter swaps, which even hides positions even more. And so while you have economists basically saying, clearly this is speculation, you'll see the traders really crying foul. And so you have a real controversy here. You have a real conflict.
Well, I mean, how do they explain? I mean, are these people actually making the argument that over the course of those 10 years that either the demand for wheat tripled or the supply was diminished by 66%, I guess? I mean,
listen,
I'm not very good
Sam,
at math. But.
Sam, this goes down to an even more a deeper core, which is this whole notion of to what extent do we make the markets tools that people use, or to what extent do we make markets into gods that people worship, you know? And throughout the 90s, what we saw is this massive sense of market is God. They should be deregulated. They have magical powers with their little magical invisible hand. And if left to their own devices, everything will work out perfectly. We have seen the outcome of these deregulated markets. We have seen them not only in financial meltdown, but we have actually seen them in terms of this unbelievable human cost. And so still people persist. They persist. And why are they persisting? Because the truth is that a lot of these guys who are deep into it, a lot of the traders and the bankers, they're actually not particularly interested in markets per se. That's just their excuse. What they're interested in are profits, and that's it. And these grain markets in particular have been transformed in such a way that there are ways right now to just churn profits out of them five times a year. For technical reasons. You have to remember, Sam, there are no laws against insider trading in wheat. This completely floored me when I learned this. It is not all like equities where you can't, you know, insider information, it's a felony, I think. You can go to jail, right? Here in the grain markets and in the other commodity markets, people trade on insider information all the time. They're making so much money.
Now, I think I know these some of these fact points from your piece in Harper's a year ago or so, but the dynamic between, I mean, of course, these commodities futures and these commodities markets were set up essentially to
to insulate the farmer from a bad year of crops, or actually growing too many crops, or being able also to have cash so that they could live throughout the year, even though they were in sort of a seasonal business. But over the years, we have seen the numbers of people who are actually buying these commodities because they're in the business of buying or selling the actual product, the actual commodity, versus speculators who are just seeing this as a trade versus anything else. That dynamic has shifted, hasn't it?
Yes, it's totally shifted. But before we even talk about that a little bit, I just want to make a point, which is that I've been talking about these commodity markets now for a couple of years, as you point out. And what I find is that the people who really should be most interested in this topic, often people like my friends who are foodies, who are very interested in local food, who are very interested in real food, that actually there's this kind of barrier between what they understand about real food and food systems and then this whole notion of financial food and commodity markets. And I think that's a real problem, because I think this situation, this kind of blindness or self-willed blindness, is really being exploited by Wall Street. There's a big wall between what they're doing and the food movement. And so that's why I'm trying to say this has got to be a part of the conversation about global food justice. When we talk about global food justice, sure, we're talking local food and slow food and all of those issues are important, but we're also talking about regulating bad players, because to answer your question, it used to be for about 100 years after the Civil War that these markets helped stabilize the price of food. That's what they were all about, helping the farmer, helping the baker stabilize the price of food, and ultimately helping the consumer and helping city dwellers, you know what they were going to pay for a price of bread. And there used to be a nice balance. Now speculators are outnumbering what are called the hedgers more than 4-1, and the markets are what they call asymmetrical. They've been subverted. They've been tipped over. The volatility is way higher than it used to be, and we've seen three tremendous price spikes, really historical price spikes, in the last 5 years. To give you some perspective on this, usually every century you see two periods of price spikes in food. We've seen three price spikes in the past 5 years. We have a new normal. And I think the sooner we get our arms around this, the sooner we can start figuring out a way to put a stop to it.
It's interesting when you talk about the sort of the detachment of your foodie friends from this part of the equation, because, I mean, I think in the book you sort of outline these maybe there's two distinct – well, I mean, you talk about the two different phenomena of the pressure on the pressure downward on suppliers. And when we talk about that, we're talking about like a Walmart, for instance, basically saying like, we're going to buy, we want our yogurt to be this, the cost this.
And what I love about this part of it, Sam, what I love about this part of the story is what's the word they're using? Sustainability. They're actually co-opting a term from environmental science, and they're saying, well, in order to be the most sustainable, we need this from our suppliers. Suppliers have to do this. What they're not talking about anything that has to do with environmental sustainability. They're talking about their own economic sustainability.
Right, right. We need you to bring in this chicken. The chicken needs to weigh this much, and we need to get it for this much. And so basically you're talking about some type of freak of nature that can only exist injected with a lot of antibiotics and fed a lot of crappy stuff. But so on one hand you have that, and then on the other hand you have this sort of financialization, which we've seen across the board, it seems to me, in the context of society, whether you're talking about financializing the mortgages in a sort of an unprecedented way. I mean, they've always been financial instruments, but even more so, but also taking brick and mortar companies. And, Mitt Romney is one of those guys who saw these companies as financial instruments rather than something that, is actually making a product and hiring people in the community.
This is essential to the arc of what we're perceiving that allowed this to happen, which is that our culture fell in love with the virtual. we're having this wild, passionate love affair with virtuality. And sure, it's great on computers to understand things virtually, but what happens is that we then fall in love with all sorts of virtualities, with indexes these days, with derivatives of all sorts, right? And so we're always seeing something in our age, really, as something right next to it, as the kind of the avatar of it. And it can make a lot of sense sometimes, and it can work, for instance, in the information business. There's some good arguments that media has benefited in some ways. But food is not media, and
right.
Food is not exactly money. And so when it comes to food, when we start talking about virtual food, as I say in my book, that's when food stops being food. And when food stops being food, well, you know, eat a virtual lunch for a few days and come back to me.
Well, and I think, you know, the thing that people should understand about this is that, you know, an avatar actually will lead you to that exact thing. What we're talking about on some level is also the idea of side bets. And
yeah.
The side bet does not really care what happens in the actual game.
The side bet
works on a slightly different dynamic. And so you have misaligned, essentially, incentives here. And
but what happens when the side bet completely outweighs
right.
the actual main attraction and starts transforming that? That's what's happened in food.
That's exactly right. And we see that also in companies. So now when I have spoken to people about the problem, the generic problem of the financialization of our economy, which again, for you know, is this virtualizing the economy in some ways, but it's also it's basically creating side bets on the economy, and
right.
where the players inside the economy are actually more concerned about their side bets, and that starts to dictate what they do in the real economy, and that skews everything. When I've had these conversations,
yeah.
some people have actually said, like, the only way that this trend is going to be reversed if corporate America, those in the supposed real economy, begin to push back against this financialization. And it seems like that's a problematic equation when it comes to food, because we have that problem on both ends.
Yeah, I think first of all, you're absolutely right, which is that I thought pizza was a big business when I walked into the corporate headquarters of Domino's. It's a $36 billion a year global business, is Global Pizza. Okay, this is like nothing compared to the $648 trillion global business in derivatives. Okay, so it's almost the scale is so different. So the question then becomes, okay, then how can even a company like Domino's, even if you add them to Tyson Foods and everybody else and Little Caesar and Papa John's, even if they were all kind of to come together and start trying to regulate the derivatives business, would they ever be able to do it? And also, are they also embedded within there? I think you're right. I think that's a real problem. Now, by the same token, they are so desperate, they meaning the corporate producers, they are so desperate to get their costs in line that they have actually been pressed into the service of regulators, of Washington regulation. So, for instance, when the law, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Law was passed, it insisted on position limits to get bankers out of the food business. In other words, you can only have a certain amount of contracts in the futures markets, and then your position is limited. This law from Dodd-Frank was put into effect by the Commodities Futures Trading Corporation, and then 1 week before it was supposed to go into effect, it was voided by D.C. District Court. Okay, this is just about a month ago. And what you saw was really phenomenal, is really very strange, which you saw letters to Washington being signed by the strangest bedfellows imaginable, by grocery associations, by oil men. All these people on the corporate level who are dealing with commodities are realizing that the banker is not their friend.
Right. And so what was the DC, what was the court's reasoning as to why? And so to be clear here, so this Dodd-Frank provision basically said you cannot come in unless you're actually using the food.
Yeah.
And
what happened is this, is that since FDR's Agriculture Act, bankers have been allowed to take positions, but only, you know, there have been limits on it. I think it was like 15,000 future contracts per financial institution that was not involved, let's say, in either buying or selling wheat. In the late 90s, very secretly at CFTC and in a very kind of subterfuge-type manner, eight banks were given position limit exemptions. The reasoning was, hey, we're trading currency on international markets, and wheat is called cash, so we're actually doing the same thing. So we should be given exemptions. We should be able to take as big a stake as we like in global wheat. And those position limits were granted in the late 1990s. And, of course, we saw what happened about, you know, less than a decade later when all this new money started pouring in and upended these markets. And so, obviously, one of the ideas of Dodd-Frank was bring back position limits. They can take a certain position, but they have to be stopped at a certain point. Okay, it seems logical, seemed reasonable to everybody. Everybody was pretty much for this, Republicans and Democrats alike. That's what's interesting about this, is that this is not necessarily simply a progressive issue, getting the bankers out of our food supply.
Right.
You'll see people across the aisle, you know, signing these letters. And then the D.C. District Court was convinced that there was, quote unquote, you know, no proof of speculation. No proof. Well, of course, nobody, as we were talking earlier in our conversation, Sam, it is really almost impossible to prove such a thing. But then again, there are a lot of things which we understand and take for granted which are impossible to prove, such as the fact that there are atoms. I mean, for every scientist, seeing is not believing. You know, we have a theory, we make predictions based on that theory, and then we believe that theory. Nobody's seen an atom. It's the same thing here. We have a theory about speculation. We see that theory in action. We see what's happened. Clearly, this is at work. But is it possible to actually go back and to say this bet was a speculative bet? That's very hard to do because of the way the markets are structured.
Now, is there, I mean, if Dodd-Frank is struck down by a D.C. Circuit Court, is there room? I mean, I don't understand why we cannot have statutory limits on what positions people can hold in certain markets, right? I mean,
A lot of people are flummoxed. A lot of people are kind of scratching their heads over this one. It seemed to be a fairly straightforward thing. There had been position limits since FDR, and now all of a sudden we cannot reinstate them, right? And so that's why everybody is pushing Congress once again to reinstate these things. And the whole notion of position limits has been remanded to Gary Gensler, who's head of the CFTC. And so Gensler, an ex-Goldman man himself, but I think he has gone through a bit of a change of heart, is going to have to decide, what are we going to do with this? How are we going to move forward now? How are we going to get the bankers out of global food supply? And what we're seeing is that this is also working at the level of the United Nations, which is that people do perceive that this is not just a national problem. It has international scope. The banks themselves have international scope. Clearly, global grain has international scope. And so even if we were to stop Goldman, you know, how about Deutsche and how about Barclays and how about all these other bad players globally? And so there has to be a global effort. And that the good news is that that global effort is starting.
And is that all it's going to take? I mean, is it basically just sort of putting some type of position limits on this is going to, at the very least, deal with that element of the problem with our food supply?
Position limits are going to help a lot. Transparency in over-the-counter markets so that we really know who's taking what. Transparency internationally is going to help so that we know how much Cargill is holding, how much ADM is holding, how much wheat China is holding. It's a secret. The other thing that I've been advocating for is a United States strategic grain reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nobody would argue that we don't need a United States strategic petroleum reserve, and we used to have a farmer-owned, it wasn't the federal government in the business, it was a farmer-owned national grain reserve. Well, once again, right around the time these position limit exemptions are granted, we get rid of our national grain reserve. Trust the global market. And a grain reserve is a great thing. For obvious reasons. It not only does it help stabilize prices, but for instance, we had a drought in the Midwest this past summer. For the first time, U.S. demand is going to outstrip U.S. supply. Maybe it would have been a good thing to have been holding a little grain in reserve. Probably a smart idea.
And so on the other aspect of this, the threat, I guess, to our food supply and certainly the threat to keeping food, healthy food cheap, is this sort of the corporatization, I guess, of food and the mass production of it. What needs to happen in that area to sort of to recorrect? That seems to me to be more a consumer based.
Yeah, I think on the industrial level as opposed to the financial level. I think on the industrial level, our big problem is monopolization. And I think we can see that most clearly, for instance, in the bad playing of, let's say, a company like Monsanto, kind of like one of the most obvious and worst players in monopolization. And they are – this is another part of the book in terms of how food has stopped being food, how food has become a legal construct, how food has become a matter of intellectual property rights, which is really what's allowing Monsanto to really push forward with their monopolistic agenda, is their profit stream from Roundup Ready crops. And so what I've been advocating also on this level of anti-monopolization on the industrial level is reform. Reform the Plant Patent Act of 1930, Sam. Let's reform this thing so that the plant patent rights maybe look different than Hollywood patent rights or other patent rights. I mean, sure, there's a reason why Hollywood movies should be protected, you know, on international markets. But once again, food is not a movie. You know, food is different. And so even the scientists I talked to, and I talked to lots of them, I spent a year going around genetic modification laboratories, even the scientists I talked to in those genetic modification labs are against those kinds of patent laws as they exist, because they are actually stopping research in food. Everybody has to pay everybody off to go even one step forward in food research. I think no matter what we think about genetic modification, right, I think everybody agrees it's kind of foolish to turn our backs on science at this point. And so it is conceivable. I met a number of people along the way who are actually working on some products that might actually conceivably help, as opposed to hurt the world, hurt nutrition, hurt the environment. And the way to stop Monsanto is to get the profit out of it.
Right. And of course, it also it disincentivizes people from fixing what already exists in some respects, because there's no money to be made there.
Well, a lot of people say if you take those intellectual property rights away from seeds, it will disincentivize people from creating new seeds. And I say it's quite the opposite. It's quite the opposite. The actual very harsh and big walls around intellectual property and seeds is actually stopping further research.
Interesting. Well, the book is Bet the Farm, Frederick Kaufman, How Food Stopped Being Food. Of course, we'll have a link to it on our blog at majority.fm. Fred, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you so much.